Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the Mueller Report and its aftermath. And Richard, with the public release of the Mueller Report last week, we've got people on both sides relitigating all of the issues surrounding the Russia investigation, as well as some new ones that the release of the report has brought up. And I'll start us off on something that I guess falls into the latter category. We have heard ever since the Justice Department released its summary of the report before the whole thing was made public that Attorney General Barr put out that the Attorney General was, in essence, an unreliable narrator. That Barr had gone out of his way to spin the report's conclusions to look as favorable to President Trump as possible. And this criticism has been renewed even more forcefully since Barr gave a press conference in the hours before the report's public release, in which many of the president's critics say now that they can look at the underlying document, you know, he really glossed over a lot of damning information in this report. So how should we think about the attorney general's role here and whether he is adequately carrying out his responsibilities to the public as opposed to, as the critics contend, acting like a personal lawyer for Donald Trump?
Well, I think it's really a kind of a complicated question, but let me sort of start from the beginning. When it comes to the four-page summary with respect to the report, the key conclusions that he stated were indeed true, that there was no finding of collusion and that was off the table, and that the quoted language was that there was not enough to say that there was any form of obstruction, but there was not enough to exonerate the president. Everything else I regard thereafter is essentially detail, and as far as I can tell, it would be irresponsible under these circumstances to say that the problem with the Barr report was that it was not exhaustive of all the evidentiary stuff. You're talking four pages. The report is 400 pages. You have to give a guy somewhat of an allowance with respect to it. When it comes to the hearing, I have sort of mixed emotions. My view about these things is attorney generals ought to keep low key and say that the report speaks for itself. But I think to some extent what happened is the Democrats had such an extreme reaction on the other side that he thought if they're going to go overboard with respect to their attack, he is not going to be able to remain a neutral arbiter in the face of all of this kind of abuse. And so what he did is he went to the defense on fairly strong. One of the interesting features about this, which turns out to be happenstance but instructive happenstance, is in June of 2018, Barr, who was then an ordinary citizen, said, look, I'm a former attorney general. Let me give you my 19-page analysis of what's going on. And I went back and read that analysis, and the truth be told, it is a more sophisticated and nuanced analysis than anything that you have with respect to the Mueller report in terms of the way in which it sets up the statutory and constitutional issues associated with the case. So when I hear about all of this stuff, what I do is I tend to think that on the Democratic side, the screeches that everything that we're talking about here is proof of obstruction is a wild overstatement. We've known for a very long time that Donald Trump is not a model of decorum in public or in private life. And what you found out is that he responded in a kind of erratic and self-pitying way with respect to these things. I have said for many, many times that he's not my role model for a public official, but I think it's extremely important to keep the difference between what counts as a criminal offense for which you up to 20 years in jail and serious other consequences, and what is a kind of form of intellectual petulance which the President of the United States should not indulge in. But I don't think the Barr report was either the Barr report or the Mueller report was supposed to analyze his psychological state. They were supposed to give some judgment about whether or not, on a narrow grounds, there was some kind of guilt or innocence. And I think with respect to that, the Mueller report wanders all over the barn, but it doesn't come up to anything because I think it was, in fact, not very careful in which it laid the foundations for what the subsequent inquiry should look like.
So what are the factors that you would need to see that you don't see in this report to persuade you of an obstruction of justice case? Because the critics are arguing that what you see detailed in this report over and over again is the president trying to get in the middle of this and slow it down or stop it up to and including an order to fire Robert Mueller, which was ignored by Don McGahn, the White House counsel at the time. So what is the element or elements that you're not seeing here that you would need to be persuaded on obstruction.
I mean, one of the things is, if you look at the report, Mueller gives up the game in the first introduction in the early pages, because he says, I'm putting aside three issues, which when you take them into account, all cut more or less in favor of Donald Trump on this particular situation. Number one is, he did not want to talk about the particular status of the president as the chief executive officer of the United States, who normally does have the power to hire and fire at will senior kinds of officials. Clearly, if you're trying to deal with an obstruction charge, you have to ask the question whether the president has gone beyond that permissible domain or whether he stayed within it. And if you don't want to talk about that, then one of the major issues that's going to work very heavily in favor of the president is not going to be talked about. The second thing is that you have to do is you have to tie the first half of the report to the second half of the report. And it was perfectly clear, if you read the first half of the report, that the exoneration on the collusion charges is pretty powerful. And so what happens is, you now have to have the situation that the president is trying to obstruct justice when he knows that he's innocent. At that particular point, God knows what the correct strategy is. But as far as I am concerned, you're willing to let the process go so long as you think it's going to be done legitimately. And it's very difficult to make out an obstruction charge, not legally impossible, but difficult to make out an obstruction charge when you're charging somebody with covering up or blocking an investigation when there's no guilt that's associated with it. The third feature is, this is not something that's done covertly. Normally, when you destroy documents, you don't do it on national television. One of the problems about Trump is, he's a guy with an immense desire for publicity, most of which is ill-founded. And all of these things start to take place in public. And generally speaking, it's rather difficult through public actions to engage in actions of obstruction of justice. So if you put all of those three things into the mix, then when you start looking at all the various actions, whether they be with Michael Cohen or whether they be with Michael Flynn or whether they be with Don McGahn, what you have to do is to say, look, he's got a repository of authority. It turns out he has no particular motive for obstruction, and he's not trying to conceal anything. And if none of those things are considered in the Mueller report, it's irresponsible. As it is.
Richard, there was a piece that ran in today's edition of the Washington Post by Hillary Clinton, no less, advising congressional Democrats, who, of course, are having an internal debate at the moment over whether impeachment is a necessary next step, that it's a false choice to say you either go forward with impeachment or just sit on your hands, that really the way to play this going forward, and she's calling here somewhat on her experience working on Watergate, is to have a series of somewhat intrusive hearings on a regular basis for as long as is necessary going forward. What do you make of that, A, as a political strategy, but B, on the legal merits?
Well, as a political strategy, I think something like that is always a mistake. What you're going to be doing is engaging in some kind of a fishing expedition on the one hand, or rehashing stuff which is already out there. This is really very, very different from the situation Watergate, where it was known that there was a definitive crime that was committed. And once it turned out that we knew that the president had tapes and was covering this thing up, we now knew that there were two crimes that were committed. With Trump, you don't have either of those particular elements. There's no conspicuous act outside of the office, and it turns out that all the interactions between them were nothing like the cover-up from Nixon. And so basically, if you want to have something that looks like impeachment go through, the rule of thumb that you learn from the Nixon case, as you learn from the Clinton case, is that the president's own party has to turn against him in order for this to have any chance of success. And the second thing, of course, is this is rich. The person who ought to be under investigation is Hillary Clinton. Because where it is very unclear as to exactly what the president did, one of the things that happens is, if you take an account of obstruction as broad as the Democrats want to push, and then you ask yourself whether or not it applies to the actions of Hillary Clinton or the Democratic National Committee or anybody else who was involved with the Steele dossier or with the submission of various papers for to the Senate or to Mueller having to do with the various kinds of investigations, the Democrats should be in very, very hot water. And I factly think that I would never want to prosecute Hillary Clinton, not because I think she's innocent, but because I think going after defeated presidential candidates is a big mistake. But if you're running an FBI operation where it turns out there's substantial evidence to believe that the president's party, that is Barack Obama, actually authorized spying through the FBI on various kinds of Trump operatives, that's a much more serious charge than anything having to do with Russia, because it means you're taking the full official power of the government and turning it against your political opponents, which is what happens in totalitarian regimes. And I think that she really ought to be very, very careful when she talks, because she, in fact, has lived Batom's life on this ever since March of 2015, when, if you recall, she was allowed to submit papers to the government after she had redacted them personally, saying, well, this is yoga lesson. This has to do with Chelsea. This is clear obstruction of justice. The decision as to whether or not these papers should or should not be included must be left to the public authorities. It cannot be done by a particular party. So what's going to happen is she's now going to invite a prolonged investigation of everything that she and the Democrats did on the Senate side. I'm not sure that that's constructive going forward politically, but I think it has much more legal foundation. And indeed, many people in the FBI have already been sacked, and some of them should not only be sacked, but probably subject to criminal punishment. So looking at this thing, it was so pious, it was terrible. You ask her, what were the grounds for obstruction of justice? She just treated it as a self-evident truth. She was a lousy campaigner. She was never much of a lawyer. And this seems to prove the fact that her deficiencies in both areas continued to dog us, notwithstanding that she's otherwise out of the public light.
In a tweet earlier today, the president wrote, "I did nothing wrong." That's all caps. "If the partisan Dems ever tried to impeach, I would first head to the U.S. Supreme Court." Richard, if you're the White House counsel and the president is floating that idea to you, how do you respond?
He's a terrible lawyer. I mean, first of all, you don't head to the United States Supreme Court. It's an appellate body which has limited scope of review. You have to go into federal district court. If you're actually looking at what's happening for impeachment, we know perfectly well what the basic rules of the game are, is that the only connection that the judiciary has with it is in cases of impeachment of the president. The Senate is going to be chaired by the Chief Justice of the United States. But virtually anything that takes place inside the House of Representatives or the Senate or in their interactions is outside the scope of the federal courts. So what you can do is you could try to head to the federal courts if what they're doing is they're trying to subpoena from you various kinds of papers for which you claim executive privilege. A subpoena does not give you the automatic right to have them. The prima facie case is that you have to be a body that can normally collect these papers, and the Congress or either House thereof has that power in connection with its oversight function. But it also turns out on the other side, there are many strong issues of executive privilege, and you're going to have to thrash those things out one way or the other. How it's going to play out depends on what the scope of the subpoena is, what kind of information you're asking for, and so forth. Right now, we've had just this conflict as to whether or not the House can get the president's tax returns on the grounds that it has supervisory authority over the IRS, which allows it to look at individual cases. But as far as I can tell, this has only been normally with an eye towards legislation and reform. And in this particular case, it's clear that it's part of a political vendetta. Does the motive influence the ability to get a subpoena? The answer is we really don't know, because we've never been put in exactly this kind of an awkward situation. So the advice that you give to Donald Trump is, remember, you got a business degree for whatever that is worth. You don't have a law degree. Your first job when you are a client is to listen to your lawyer. His first instinct is to tell everybody else what to do. And I will just repeat the old maxim. When you're putting a deal together, what happens is the client tells the lawyer what he wants to do and the lawyer executes it. When you're dealing with any kind of civil liability or criminal sanction, the lawyer tells the client what to do. And the client who doesn't listen to the lawyer is as big a fool as you could possibly imagine. Donald Trump is not very good at listening to people. The greatest peril he has to his own legal position is himself.
Final question. All the major players here seem a little too raw to have much in the way of perspective. But let's try to think about this whole process from the perspective of 20 years in the future. Once passions fade, how do you think history is likely to judge the Mueller investigation and all of the ensuing controversies?
Well, I think what it will do is it will find failures everywhere around. I think the Mueller investigation should have never been the Mueller investigation. As I said, on constant number of times, there were two fatal defects from the outset. One of them, this was not an investigation into a particular criminal activity. It was, you look anywhere you want to see if there's anything that can involve that. I'm very much in favor of investigations that have criminal powers that are not trying to investigate some kind of a determinate offense. Secondly, there are very strong rules in the FBI and everybody else with respect to conflict of interest. Mr. Comey was a good friend of Mr. Mueller. Mr. Mueller should not have been involved in the investigation since he knew that Mr. Comey was a central figure whose conduct would be at stake. He should not have done it. Mr. Rosenstein made a mistake. The correct way to give the charge is not to ask how it was that the Trump administration was in cahoots with the Russian. It should have been what was the impact of the Russians on the investigation, and you have to bring in the activities of both parties, but not one. And I think all of that together would be a very strong ground if Trump had said so at the beginning. This thing has to start over again, but he felt trapped because he had appointed Jeff Sessions as attorney general. Sessions recused himself, which was properly correct under the circumstances. What should have happened, in my judgment, is he should not have recused himself. He should have resigned so that Trump could have appointed another attorney general who was not free of the taint and therefore had an attorney general keeping control of the overall situation. So I think that Trump made huge mistakes. I think Mueller made huge mistakes. I think the reactions that took place afterwards, the Republicans have by and large been relatively quiet because everything in the report seems to cut in their direction. The Democrats have waxed quasi-hysterical with respect to this. I think, in effect, if they continue this up going further, it's going to hurt their political campaign. It's going to take them away from bread and butter issues, and it's going to make them look every bit as petty as the Democrats turn out to be. I think the old pro Nancy Pelosi understands all of this stuff and is trying to tamp it down. The very restless progressive wing is trying to push it. And she's faced with the additional kind of misfortune of having a potential nominees or candidates on the Democratic side who are way over to the left and therefore not only push a strong agenda, which is hard enough to sell to middle America, but are also trying to push the impeachment. The Democrats run a very serious risk of getting the reelection of Donald Trump because it turns out there are many people like myself who deeply have deep reservations about him. But if the choice comes between an imperfect Trump and a hopelessly inept Democratic Party, I think a lot of people, myself included, notwithstanding the fact they're under no illusions about the president, would vote to keep the status quo ante. You put Bernie Sanders in the White House to paraphrase Paul Krugman. He says, we'll never get out of the recession that we have with Donald Trump, and the market goes up 200 points. My guess is you get somebody like Bernie Sanders, the market will go down 25%.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.